Okay, recorder's working. So, good morning, this is Bio 241, and it is September 16th, and we're to go through the cellular respiration and metabolism chapter. We started talking about just an overview of cellular respiration, and I'm going to keep the slide on the right there pretty much the whole class, just so that you can kind of keep track where we are in this process. But we're going to talk about some of these individual processes in the PowerPoints, but you should always kind of keep track where we are. Okay. Does anybody have a question on this slide right at the moment? Okay, there's a lot of details in here, and probably the most important detail is not even on this slide. Like, I want to know what the whole point of all of these chemical reactions are sometime. Maybe at the end of class today, I'll ask you that. Oops. I guess I have to click right here. All right, so the first reaction that we're going to be looking at, and I guess I'm going to go back over to the slide on the right, is glycolysis. And what the heck is glycolysis? It has something to do with glucose after it is inside the cell. So we're starting right here. Right, so we're looking at the cytosol. Remember, there's a little bit of difference between cytosol and cytoplasm. Cytoplasm includes organelles and things like that, but we're just talking about enzymes that are dissolved in the fluid part of the cell, which is what? The cytosol, actually. Okay, so glycolysis, going back to the slide on the left, all right, is a metabolic pathway by which glucose is converted into 2-pyruvates, right, which you can see on the slide on the right. This pathway does not require oxygen. And when we say pathway, a metabolic pathway, what kind of connotation does that have? What kind of meaning does that have for you? One chemical reaction or a number of chemical reactions all linked together, one after another, after another, after another?
Number.
Yeah, right? It's a whole bunch of chemical reactions that are catalyzed by enzymes. And some of those enzymes can be regulated by other factors inside the cell. All right, and let me just get my arrow options working so it doesn't keep disappearing. All right, here's the overall equation for glycolysis. It starts with glucose, and it has a couple cofactors like NAD, and it's going to take 2-adenosine diphosphates. It's going to phosphorylate these 2-adenosine diphosphates. Right, and glycolysis is basically going to clip glucose in half to produce 2-pyruvates, right, and it's going to reduce NAD, producing NADH, and in that process, it's going to produce, by taking the ADP and 2-inorganic phosphates, 2-ATP, right, and so that's really what we're after right here is ATP. And if we think of glucose, can anybody remember how many carbon atoms are in one glucose molecule? There are six. And if we snip glucose exactly in half, how many each of those molecules are going to have how many carbon atoms? Yeah, there's going to be three, and you're going to end up with two of them. So we're going to look and see that pyruvate or pyruvic acid has 3 carbon atoms, and that's why you end up with 2 of them. All right, so here is an overview of the energy requirements or the energy yield of the chemical reaction of glucose going to 2-pyruvic acids. So glucose enters the cell, and before glycolysis can really get started, it has to be phosphorylated. All right, so here it takes a couple ATP, so it takes some energy to get glycolysis working at the cost of the cell, right? Because you don't really want to spend ATP unless you can get something worthwhile out of it. And you can see as glucose goes to this diphosphate form way up over here, is this an exergonic reaction or an endergonic reaction going from glucose to step one up over here? Exer or endergonic? Okay, endergonic, right? Because if the products have more energy than the reactants, that is an endergonic reaction. And where is that energy coming from? It's coming from the chemical bonds in ATP when glucose is phosphorylated. All right, there's something else, too, that happens. Remember that phosphate group is a highly polar group, and when glucose is phosphorylated, then it's even more impossible for it to diffuse through the cell membrane. So when glucose is phosphorylated not once but twice, it is really trapped inside the cell, and that cell then can use it for its own energy purposes. All right, so the reaction has been primed, and then there are a series of other chemical reactions, a number of steps, in which NAD is reduced to NADH, and NADH is carrying something. It's carrying some high energy electrons. And so remember, what is a coenzyme? It's a large organic molecule that is transporting valuable stuff to another set of chemical reactions. And the valuable stuff that NADH is transporting to another set of chemical reactions that we're going to look at later on are those high energy electrons. So that is why we say, right, NAD becomes reduced, because it's accepting electrons. That's the definition of a reduction reaction. Okay, and if I switch over to the slide over here on the right, I can tell you where those electrons are going to be used, and it's going to be in this very last step over here. They're going to be used by the electron transport chain inside the mitochondria. All right, but we'll put that aside for the moment. All right, so we're still thinking glycolysis. We have some reduced NADH. Where is this taking place? In the cytosol, right? Looking on the slide at the right, here we are in the cytosol. All right, then we have some other chemical intermediates, and there is enough release of energy. Okay, as a matter of fact, I should probably ask you this question. Going from this plateau here with the number 1 on it all the way down to pyruvate right here, now is that an endergonic reaction or exergonic reaction? Exergonic, right? Because now the products have less energy than the reactants right here. So this chemical set of reactions right here is releasing a lot of energy. And what has evolved is a system to now take that energy and use it, right, to drive this reaction, 2-ADP plus 2-inorganic phosphate to 2-ATP. Now, what kind of reaction is this? Is this ADP going to ATP, exergonic or endergonic? That is an endergonic reaction. That's unfavorable unless you couple it with what? Another reaction which is highly exergonic, and that's what glycolysis is. It provides a lot of energy so that actually ATP can be made, which is a highly unfavorable reaction. Okay, and as a matter of fact, through this process of glycolysis, how many ATPs are made? Okay, I see 2 here and 2 at this step right here, but remember, what did we have to spend to get glycolysis going? We had to spend 2 ATPs, so the net reaction right here is just 2 ATPs for glycolysis. So some of the bullet points that you should have in your mind are, what's the yield for ATP for glycolysis, starting at glucose, ending up with pyruvate right here? It is just 2 ATPs. And in terms of other high-energy carriers, NADH, 2 NADHs are produced as well. Okay, and glycolysis has an endergonic part and also what a highly exergonic part, which is used to make ATP. ATP from glycolysis is made just from the use of enzymes, right? When ADP is put together with inorganic phosphate, sometimes we call that phosphorylation. And so we're phosphorylating ADP to make an ATP molecule. And this kind of phosphorylation step, when it's made by an enzymatic reaction, is called substrate level phosphorylation, substrate level. Okay. The other interesting thing about glycolysis is that this happens whether oxygen is present in the cell or not. It's independent of the state of oxygen inside the cell. Nowhere in here do we see an oxygen molecule being necessary. Right? So that's another reason why we say this is substrate level phosphorylation. And if we actually look at all the chemical reactions, all the steps in glycolysis, we see it right here. Oh, it's a little bit off the slide, but this is a good test, right? This right here is not an exam figure, unless I get a lot of requests for this to be an exam figure. You should at least know what's in this box right here that's not being shown. I don't have it on my screen. Do you have it on your screen? No, it's missing from your screen. And as a matter of fact, maybe to help you view it a little bit, I'm going to turn the light down a little bit. What is the entry molecule to glycolysis? It is glucose, right? And of course, you would know that it has 6 carbon atoms. It doesn't have any phosphate atoms on it. So the first 2 steps, glucose is phosphorylated into glucose 6-phosphate. And what that means is that the very last carbon atom accepts that phosphate group. Okay? And then it gets converted into fructose 6-phosphate, and then it gets phosphorylated again at the expense of an ATP, and now we have fructose 1,6-diphosphate or biphosphate. That means then at either end of that sugar molecule, it has been phosphorylated. The first carbon has a phosphate group on it, and the number 6 carbon has a phosphate group on it. Okay, so that's what that means. And so this is what? Endergonic, it's requiring energy, and then that allows the rest of glycolysis to proceed through some rearrangements of the molecule, and then the splitting of the molecule. Right here we have fructose being split into these 2-3 carbon fragments right here, and via this reaction pathway, eventually we end up with 2 pyruvic acid molecules. And here you can see a CH3H4O3. That's just a nice simple 3-carbon molecule. So basically what we've done is chopped glucose in half, right smack in the middle, and we've gained 2 ATP molecules and 2 NADHs through this particular process. Now I think the other important reason why that I'm showing you this slide right here is when we look at glycolysis, I see that some solid arrows pointing down, right, from glucose to pyruvate, but do you see any other arrows in this metabolic pathway? You see some dashed arrows that are actually going from pyruvic acid back up to glucose, right? And so that chemical process can take place as well. And some of these reaction steps right here, there's no free energy change, which means that this chemical reaction can run in the forward direction, which I'm going to define as glucose to pyruvate, or it can run in the reverse direction, being what, from pyruvic acid back to glucose. And you should be aware of why does that happen? How could that happen? How could this reaction actually run backwards? There's a law that we looked at last time. The law of mass action, exactly right, or Le Chatelier's principle, right? So that if we have a buildup of products, namely pyruvate, for instance, or maybe NADH right here, that is going to force this reaction to run in the reverse direction. And when glycolysis stops or even runs in the reverse direction, what happens to ATP synthesis? It stops. Yeah, it actually stops. And is that really good for the cell? Not under most circumstances, because most cells need a gob of ATP, right, every second. All right, so that's something interesting to think about. All right, so glycolysis is a term that we use to describe the forward reaction, glucose going to pyruvate and producing those energy molecules. Okay, now if there is no oxygen inside the cell, then I guess I'll go back to this slide right here. If there's no oxygen inside the cell, then this pyruvic acid is kind of trapped. It's kind of at a dead end. It really has no place to go. Right? Usually it's imported into the mitochondria, where the mitochondria make even more ATP from it. But when there's no oxygen, it builds up inside the cell, as well as NADH builds up inside the cytosol. And as we said, as these materials build up, what does that have a tendency to do? Shut down glycolysis, or make it run in the reverse direction, costing the cells ATP that glycolysis makes. And of course, we know under most circumstances we can't have that happening. So under anaerobic conditions, the cell does something with pyruvic acid. There's a special little side reaction right here that we call the lactic acid pathway. All right? And the lactic acid pathway is real important because it prevents that end product inhibition that is the result of the accumulation of NADHs and even pyruvic acid inside the cytosol, right? Because it's going to get rid of pyruvic acid and these NADHs under anaerobic conditions. So here is the chemical formula for pyruvic acid or pyruvate. And with this enzyme right here, lactate dehydrogenase, pyruvic acid can be reduced into this form, which is lactic acid. And when that happens, NADH becomes oxidized, right? And so now you're building NADH levels back up inside the cell. What is NADH necessary for? If we go back, here we have NADH as a necessary substrate for glycolysis, all right? So the lactate acid pathway, or sometimes we call that the fermentation pathway, is a way of getting rid of pyruvic acid and another way of building up NAD so that glycolysis, okay, remains open and running so that the cell has some ATP. So it's a very valuable kind of reaction. So let's look at the slide on the right. Where are we over here on the slide on the right? So we have glucose going through pyruvate, or pyruvic acid, right? So don't forget, what's an important metabolite that's being produced that your cells need? ATP, right? All right, under anaerobic conditions, this pyruvic acid cannot enter the mitochondria. All right, and under anaerobic conditions, NADH is going to build up inside the cytosol. Pyruvic acid is going to build up. That's going to have a tendency to stop glycolysis. But here is that little side reaction that can take pyruvate and produce lactic acid. And in the process, what else is regenerated that is necessary for glycolysis? If we look back on the slide over here on the left, yes, then this NADH gets converted back to NAD, and that, again, just from the concept of Le Chatelier's principle, right, is going to force glycolysis in the forward direction, at least producing some ATP for the cell. So the fermentation pathway is very important. And you should know, under what conditions does that take place? Anaerobic, which means without oxygen. Okay, now did you do a fermentation experiment in lab? Did you do that today, this week yet? No? There's another kind of fermentation process that's kind of fun to take a look at, all right? And you're going to do that with yeast, but I think it's just interesting to take a look at it. Yeast get rid of NADH and pyruvic acid a little bit different way. It starts with pyruvic acid. I haven't memorized the formula, all right, but I suppose I can get pretty close to it. All right, so here's pyruvic acid right here. What the yeast reaction does is that it decarboxylates pyruvic acid, all right, and it uses NADH, all right, and that produces what? NAD plus right here. And then you end up with carbon dioxide, right? And so under these kinds of fermentation processes, that produces what? Bubbles, for instance. And then how many carbons are you left with? You're left with two, and that molecule is going to look like this. And remember, all these single dashed lines right there, that single line is just a hydrogen atom. Okay, does anybody know what this molecule is right here? So we got two molecules. Instead of just one. Instead of lactate, we have two. We've got carbon dioxide and this thing right here. Okay? Maybe not, because probably you haven't taken a lot of biochemistry. But this is ethyl alcohol. Okay? What is ethyl alcohol? That's adult beverage. Okay? So yeast will produce CO2, which of course probably most of us use, or somebody around the house uses to bake bread, because that CO2 makes bread rise. Or maybe if you like to brew beer at home or something like that, all right, not only do you get a carbonated beverage, but you make it in an adult form over here, because what can you tell me about ethyl alcohol? Ethyl alcohol is, if you were to drink it, what would happen to you? You would get drunk, right? You'd become intoxicated, because ethyl alcohol is toxic to our nervous systems, right? So it's a nervous system depressant, and of course if you drink enough of it, it's lethal, right? So it is toxic. So now you can imagine why we don't have this chemical reaction in our body to get rid of NADH under anaerobic conditions, right? But yeast do, because yeast don't have a nervous system to worry about, right? They don't. So what if they're... If they build up this toxic compound, they don't have a nervous system to be hurt. But humans do. All right. So I think that's kind of interesting, because if we did have this chemical reaction right here to protect glycolysis, all right, if we held our breath, what would happen? We would get drunk just by holding our breath, right? Because this happens under anaerobic conditions. Or if you were to exercise very strenuously, you would become intoxicated, right? And so for an adaptive feature, you can see that would not be very adaptive at all. So in mammals, we have the lactic acid pathway, not the alcohol fermentation pathway. So you'll be able to relate that to lab when you get to lab. All right, so you should understand the importance of this lactic acid pathway, which on the slide on the right happens where? In the cytosol, And what does it do? It allows glycolysis to stay open by regenerating NAD and getting rid of pyruvic acid. And it just so happens that this lactic acid right here can diffuse out of the cell, so it can leave the cell. We're going to talk about that in just a little bit. As a matter of fact, maybe right now. All right, so the lactic acid pathway keeps the glycolysis working. Will produce what? Two ATPs per glucose under anaerobic conditions, right? So you always got to remember anaerobic conditions. And right now it's not producing NADHs because those are being regenerated into NAD to keep glycolysis working. Remember those red blood cells, they don't have a nucleus. As a matter of fact, they don't have much in the way of any kind of organelle, including mitochondria. So they can't make ATP. With mitochondria, they only use this lactic acid pathway, the anaerobic part of glycolysis and the lactic acid pathway, to make just two ATPs for every glucose molecule. And it also happens in skeletal muscle and heart muscle and other kinds of organs, right, when oxygen level falls. Like, for instance, if there's a disruption in the blood supply, if there is a clot in a blood vessel, right, or if there is a bleed in a blood vessel, if it ruptures or something like that, okay, and also during heavy exercise or any kind of vascular blockage to a tissue is going to produce lactic acid. And for instance, you've probably experienced a muscle cramp in your life. Maybe you're walking down the sidewalk and all of a sudden you get a cramp in your leg or gastrocnemius or something, and it contracts and it turns into this solid mass. Right, instead of being a nice flaccid muscle where blood can get in, it turns into the solid mass, and blood can't get into that muscle. It's using up a lot of ATP, but the lactic acid pathway is producing a little bit of ATP. But how does it feel when you have that muscle cramp? Yeah, it hurts like hell because that muscle is now producing a lot of lactic acid, and it produces pretty extreme pain when that happens. Okay. And as a matter of fact, anytime there's a vascular blockage, you would feel that pain. Okay, let's look at a couple other metabolic pathways. Glycogenesis and glycogenolysis. All right, so if we go back and to the slide on the right, we have glycolysis over here. All right, if you look at the root of that word, glycolysis, basically what's the major thing that's happening in glycolysis? The breakdown, right? Lysis meaning the breakdown of glucose. Now we see that same kind of term over here, lysis, when we look at glycogenolysis. All right, that's the lysis, not of glucose, but another important chemical, and that is glycogen. Okay? And glycogenesis, right, doesn't have much, it has a little bit to do with glucose, but this is not the breakdown of glycogen, this is the formation or the synthesis. Okay. That's really important in muscles. Muscles do store glycogen, but by far the most important organ for the production and storage of glycogen is the liver, you know, and that's what we see back over here on the slide on the right. That's why we have this liver right here. And what do you see in the liver? Glycogen. All right, so we got two metabolic pathways that are important right here. Here we have glucose outside of the liver. If the liver takes up glucose and makes glycogen out of it, guess what we call that? That is glycogenesis, right? And that happens when? When you're in a fed state, right? When you are absorbing glucose from the digestive tract. Now, can you track where the cursor is going fairly easily when I flip from one screen to the other? Or should I tell you where it's going? I don't know. Yeah, I should tell you where it's going? Okay. Okay, so I'm on the slide on the right. So glucose is going to be maintained pretty high concentrations in the blood when you're in a fed state, right? And so under those conditions, right, the liver is going to take up some glucose and make glycogen out of it, because glycogen is just a polymer of glucose. And the name of that process of glucose going to glycogen, if we look at the slide on the left over here, is glycogenesis. All right. The reverse process is glycogenolysis. Going back to the slide on the right, when does that happen? And who does that? It's the liver. Only the liver is altruistic and is willing to sacrifice its glycogen, the breakdown of glycogen producing glucose, when you are in the fasted state. And that's under hormonal control that we're going to look at a little bit later in the class. But here is This arrow right here, you should realize, is a double-ended arrow. As drawn, glycogen to glucose, what's the name of that process? Glycogenolysis, right? And if we were to draw a little arrowhead up over here, glucose going from outside the cell to inside liver cells, that would be glycogenesis. All right, so make sure you know how to spell those words. And if you can't see that these words are different, you got to get a new pair of glasses before the test. Okay, they are very similar, and before you say it or spell it, you have to think about what's going on. And if you can't see the difference, you got to see the difference. Okay. All right, so the reason why cells, especially the liver, don't store glucose as just a simple glucose molecule, right, because maybe it's going to store millions of glucose molecules, that would change the osmotic properties inside the cell. And if glucose concentration builds up inside the cell, it's going to increase osmosis inside the cell, which is what? Water moving by diffusion inside the cell. The cell is going to swell up and it's eventually going to burst. So taking all those particles and making one particle out of it, one glycogen particle, that alleviates that osmotic pressure in building up. Okay, so glucose is stored as glycogen. And then under the fasted conditions, then glycogenesis will clip out of glucose from glycogen and put it back in the blood. And that's the only organ that can do that because the liver has an enzyme that can take a phosphate off of a glucose molecule. What's that? What's the name of an enzyme that takes a phosphate and puts it on a molecule as opposed to the name of the enzyme that takes it off? The one that puts it on is a kinase. One that puts it on is a kinase. The one that takes it off is a phosphatase. And the liver has the glucose 6-phosphatase, which then produces a naked glucose, which then can be secreted back on the slide on the right over here from the liver back into the blood. All right, it's for other parts of your body to use. All right, so here are a number of metabolic pathways that you should become familiar with. The first four we're kind of talking about already. Right, glycolysis, that's just the splitting of glucose into two pyruvic acids. Glycogenesis is the production of glycogen from glucose. Glycogenolysis is the reverse of that process when you're in a fasted state. And then gluconeogenesis, we haven't talked about yet, but I've alluded to it. Okay, if we look back over here on the slide on the right, we can take non-sugar molecules, maybe some amino acids, pyruvic acid and glycerol. How many carbon atoms does glycerol have? Can anybody remember? Glycerol? When it makes a triglyceride? Yeah, so there are three. And how many carbon atoms does pyruvic acid have? Three. So they're related in that way, right? So how many pyruvic acids would you need to make a glucose? You would need two. How many glycerols would you need to make a glucose? Two. Right, so glycerol can enter this pathway, can enter glycolysis if it runs backwards, right, to make new glucose. So when glycolysis is running backward, when a cell is making glucose from non-sugar molecules, we call that, back over here, the slide on the left, gluconeogenesis. Right, so there are a number of different ways that glucose can be maintained in the blood, right, and these are all important for understanding diabetes mellitus. Right, of course, diet is really important. Right, you can't overeat glucose, but there are other ways that glucose can be maintained in your blood. The secretion of glucose from the liver by glycogenolysis, or the production of glucose from gluconeogenesis, and that's really the aim of many other kinds of treatments for diabetes mellitus that target these other pathways. Right, if diet alone or diet and exercise alone don't help the diabetic condition. All right, so we're going to be looking at these different terms right here. And again, if you can't see that they're spelled differently, guess what you have to do? Pair of glasses by the next test. Okay? So you got to practice pronouncing these terms and even spelling them out because these are really important as we're going to see. Okay, a couple other terms right here. Lipogenesis, using what we learned so far. This doesn't have to do with glucose, but it has to do with lipid molecules, like for instance triglycerides, right? The production of a triglyceride from glycerol and three fatty acids, okay? The reverse of that process is lipolysis. So can you see the the nice parity here that we see with glycolysis and lipolysis. Lipolysis is the splitting of a triglyceride into its basic building blocks, which is a glycerol and three fatty acids. Okay, so these are good definitions, and we might get to talk about ketogenesis at some point in time. All right, so here is a pretty important exam figure. We see some glycogenesis and, I almost forgot the sign-in sheet. Please sign the sign-in sheet and pass it around. Glycogenesis and glycogenolysis, so we're focusing our attention on glycogen, I think pretty much in the liver. All right, skeletal muscles don't undergo the secretion of glucose, right, because they phosphorylate glucose right away, and then it's trapped inside the muscle cell, can't get out. Only the liver has that glucose 6-phosphatase. And remember, a phosphatase takes a phosphate off, so glucose can actually be secreted from a liver cell. So I want you to be able to name these different pathways right here. So what on this study guide, what do we have? We have glucose being absorbed by this cell, and it uses an ATP, forming an ADP. Where does that other phosphate go? I see 3 phosphates on ATP. I see 2 phosphates on ADP. Where did that third phosphate go? It got added to glucose when it entered this cell, and it produced glucose 6-phosphate. What's the name of the enzyme that does that? We can practice some nomenclature right here. Generally, what is the name of an enzyme that adds a phosphate? That's a kinase. And what's the substrate? Glucose. So that enzyme would be glucose kinase. Okay, which would make glucose 6-phosphate. Now, this thing is trapped inside the cell. It can't leave because that phosphate group is a highly polar group, can't get through the cell membrane. Then it goes through a little bit of a rearrangement right here from 6-phosphate to 1-phosphate, flips to the other side of the molecule. And name this process right here where glucose 1-phosphate releases the phosphate. Okay, but now that glucose becomes incorporated into a huge glycogen molecule. What do we call that? Glycogenesis. So this is number one is glycogenesis, right? The production of glycogen from glucose 1-phosphate. And under what kind of conditions does that happen? When you're in a fed state, for instance, when you're in a fed state, plenty of glucose in the blood. All right, and then when you're in a fasted state, your blood glucose starts to go down, and so the liver does something very nice. It starts to release glucose from glycogen. So here's a process. Glycogen, all right, is going to be, the glucose is going to be snipped off, and inorganic phosphate is going to be added to that glucose. So glycogen going to a number of glucose 1-phosphates. What's number 2 right here? That's glycogenolysis. Yeah, so here's glycogenolysis. All right, and so then with this little rearrangement right here, this glucose 6-phosphate can be dephosphorylated, and then that glucose can be secreted into the blood, and then you should know, of course, the name of this enzyme right here. Glucose 6? That might even be an online quiz question. Glucose 6-phosphatase. Phosphatase, right? A phosphatase takes a phosphate off of the glucose. The kinase puts it on. So maybe in your notes, you know, put kinase right here. Glucose kinase, over here put phosphatase, just as a way to help remember that. All right, but the liver can do other things with this glucose. It can actually donate it to glycolysis inside the cell. For instance, if the liver itself is in need of ATP, it can use it to make ATP. All right, so I think this is instructive for you to see what glycogenesis is and what glycogenolysis is. All right, here is the Cori cycle. Let's apply that previous slide to something that is important, and that is the relationship between exercising skeletal muscles and the liver, and how homeostasis in terms of blood glucose levels are maintained. All right, so here we have a skeletal muscle. Let's see, how do I want to begin talking about this? Here we have glucose, okay, going to pyruvic acid. What would you call number 2? Step number 2. Glucose to pyruvic acid. Glycolysis. That's just glycolysis. We're kind of missing the first phosphorylation step. Okay. So this happens when that muscle is exercising, when it needs ATP, right? Because glycolysis is going to produce some ATP. But under anaerobic conditions, when a muscle is exercising very strenuously, blood can't get to it if it's contracted, right? What happens to pyruvic acid? It can't enter the mitochondria, right? It's going to be converted into lactic acid that's going to regenerate what important molecule for glycolysis? NAD, that's going to regenerate NAD from NADH, right? So pyruvic acid to lactic acid, what would we call step number three right here? The lactic acid pathway, right? Or you could say lactate fermentation. There's a couple of different names in your textbook for it. Okay, so that happens under anaerobic conditions. You might want to jot that down. Pyruvic acid can't leave the cell, but fortunately, lactic acid can. It goes into the blood, and when it's in the blood, where does it go? Everywhere, including the liver. The liver will take up lactic acid, and it will reconvert lactic acid back into pyruvic acid because there is basically no free energy change between pyruvic acid and lactic acid, but it is going to convert an NAD back to NADH when that happens. So we have a pyruvic acid right here. So this is just the lactic acid pathway going in reverse. We don't have a special name for that one, right? That's just the reverse of the lactic acid fermentation pathway. And then the liver will take that pyruvic acid, not one of them, but how many, and make a glucose out of it. It will take two and make a glucose out of it. So what are we going to call pathway number six right here? Oh, can I even think of it? That is gluconeogenesis. Gluconeogenesis, right? When you take non-sugar molecules and make a glucose. That really means what? The new making of glucose, the new genesis of glucose, which is what? Glycolysis running backwards. So the liver will do that, make glucose out of it. And then the liver has a couple choices of what to do with that glucose. It can, using a phosphatase, right, number 7 is a glucose 6 phosphatase, it can re-secrete it in the blood, and when it's in the blood, where does it go? Everywhere, including that exercising muscle a little bit, okay, gets into that exercising muscle, and the muscle then can generate some ATP out of it, right, when it produced by running glycolysis. So the liver is helping the energy demands of this muscle cell because of this cycle right here that we call the Cori cycle. Okay, but there has to be nice communication via the blood between these exercising muscles and the liver. All right, what are some other pathways that we should look at? Let's go back to the liver over here, slide on the left. If you have glucose 6-phosphate and it's incorporated into glycogen, okay, what is this arrow called? Glycogenesis. Right? Or if the liver decides to split glycogen down into glucose 6-phosphate, what is that called? Glycogenolysis, right? So you got glycogenesis, glycogenolysis, right? And the same thing for, right, this skeletal muscle cell. Skeletal muscle can synthesize glycogen via glycogenesis, right? Or it can chop off glucose from glycogen and use it for glycolysis via number 1 right here, for instance, like during exercise, and that's what we call glycogenolysis. Glycogenolysis. Glycogenesis, number 9, glycogenolysis, number 1. All right, so these are really nice fancy exam figures that you should have a nice concept in your mind of, and a good place to start is, if it doesn't make sense, you just have to memorize it. Right, and look at it, and then it will start to make some sense. Okay. Number 7, right here. Yes, we got glucose 6-phosphate going to glucose. So are we putting a phosphate on or taking a phosphate off? We're taking a phosphate off. That enzyme is a phosphatase, and so we would call that enzyme glucose 6-phosphatase. So 7 is glucose 6-phosphatase. That's the enzyme that takes a phosphate off of glucose 6-phosphate. Okay? All right, so this is a really handy slide. Okay. So, aerobic respiration. Let's turn our attention to aerobic respiration a little bit. And aerobic respiration, if we look on the slide on the right over here, right, this is after pyruvic acid is produced by glycolysis. if this cell, right now we're inside the cell, if there is oxygen inside the cell, that pyruvic acid can enter what organelle if oxygen is present? Mitochondria. What's the job of mitochondria that you learned way back when in a biology or anatomy class? It produces a lot of ATP. How much ATP did glycolysis produce? Two. Yeah, big deal, two. That's not very much, right? That's not enough to keep our brains alive. Maybe some tissues that aren't doing anything, that they can live on two ATPs for every glucose, but most can't. All right, so we want something called aerobic respiration, which is all of this stuff down over here, and this happens inside the mitochondria. Okay, so let's take a look at this. This cycle down here is called the Krebs cycle. All right, so the carbons in pyruvic acid can enter the Krebs cycle in the mitochondria, and that's in the matrix of the mitochondria under aerobic conditions. Now, where is the matrix at? Can anybody picture where the matrix of a mitochondria is? That's the inner compartment, right? Here is the outer membrane of a mitochondria, but mitochondria are pretty fancy because they have also an inner membrane that has all of these little other deviations in it that we call cristae. And this inner compartment right here is what we call the matrix. Right? That fluid compartment is different than this one. That's different than the cytosol. This is just called the intermembrane space of the mitochondria. Okay, so pyruvic acid can enter and go into the matrix, but before it can enter the Krebs cycle, there is a preparatory reaction. All right, so what I want to write down right here are some important reactions. What did we look at first? We looked at glycolysis. Okay, a second important reaction is going to be the preparatory reaction. So we're looking at only under aerobic conditions, and then molecules are going to flow into the Krebs cycle, and the fourth right here is going to be the electron transport chain. All right, so I wrote this on the board, these four important pathways, because that really nice slide that you see on the right doesn't have the preparatory reaction in it. You just have pyruvic acid like scooting right into the Krebs cycle, even though you have two arrows right here. That tiny, tiny little arrow right there, maybe you should label that the preparatory reaction. All right, the little arrow, see the cursor on the right-hand slide, this little arrow right here? Okay, that's a preparatory reaction that precedes the Krebs cycle. All right, so I've got that as step number two over here. All right, so here is, if we look over on the left right here, we've got pyruvic acid, 1, 2, 3 carbon atoms, once again. This is the preparatory reaction to the Krebs cycle. This pyruvic acid is going to be decarboxylated. This carboxyl group is going to come off. Then we have how many carbon units left over? We've got two, and it's going to be joined to this molecule right here. Here you see a nice sulfhydryl group. Right, so it interacts with this carbonyl group right here, and it forms something called acetyl coenzyme A. And this is a large molecule. And what can you tell me about a coenzyme again? What is? It's a large organic molecule, and its function is to do what? Transport, carry things from one chemical reaction to another, or from one place of the cell to another. And coenzyme A is going to be carrying what around inside the mitochondria? That acetyl group, or you could say acetate group, it's this two carbon group right here. And we don't see three carbons because what happened to the third one that was in pyruvic acid? It has produced CO2. And what do you do with CO2? You exhale it out of your body, right? So that is one place where carbon dioxide comes from. Another good question is, what organelle produces carbon dioxide that you have to breathe out of your body? Where are we at right now? If we look at the slide on the right, where's that preparatory reaction at? It's in the mitochondria, right? So mitochondria are producing that CO2 that is an excretory product that we have to excrete from our body by exhaling. Okay, so this is a preparatory reaction, but It's kind of an important reaction because it's a reduction reaction. NAD is reduced to NADH. And NAD, not only is acetyl coenzyme A a coenzyme, what can you tell me about NADH? It is also a coenzyme, right? It's a coenzyme. It's carrying something from one set of chemical reactions to another. And what the heck is NADH carrying around with it? And you just want to think high energy electrons. So later on in this process, right, we can even make more ATP from NADH because it has some high energy value to it trapped in the form of some electrons. And if you want to see where those electrons are in the NADH molecule, you could go back to the previous chapter, right? The very last slide in the previous chapter. You don't have to memorize what NADH looks like or FAD, but they're related compounds and they're even related to ADP or AMP, adenosine monophosphate. Okay, so I just wanted to go over what a coenzyme was again. So right here on this slide, say preparatory reaction, where pyruvic acid is converted into acetyl-CoA, but fortunately you get some NADH is out of it. That's a valuable compound. All right, so the preparatory reaction is complete. What do we want to do next? We want, right, acetyl coenzyme A to donate that acetyl group to the Krebs cycle right here. Where is that taking place? Inside the mitochondria again, inside the matrix of the mitochondria. Supposedly there's a way to do this in the air. Okay. All right, so here is the Krebs cycle right here. We've got, let's just kind of look at this really quickly. Got glycolysis that produces 3-carbon pyruvic acid right here. Of course, two of them. The pyruvic acid can enter the mitochondria. And it can go through the preparatory reaction producing an NADH. It becomes decarboxylated. So now you've got how many carbon fragment left over? Yeah, we went with 3, now down to 2 because of that decarboxylation. Coenzyme A is also added to it that carries that acetyl group to the Krebs cycle. All right, now under what kind of conditions can that pyruvic acid enter the mitochondria? Only aerobic conditions, right? It won't happen under anaerobic conditions. But don't forget about that side reaction under anaerobic conditions, the lactic acid pathway. All right, so now we have 2 carbon atoms donated to the Krebs cycle, and there are a number of intermediates right here. You don't have to know much about this cycle, except that in one turn of the cycle, right, it's going to release, there are going to be 2 more decarboxylation steps. Here's another carbon dioxide that's released. Here's another carbon dioxide is released. And what organelle is producing the CO2? Again, it's the mitochondria. Okay, and in particular, these 2 CO2s are produced by what metabolic pathway? The Krebs cycle, right? So all that CO2 that you're breathing out of your body comes from the activity of mitochondria, 1 carbon dioxide from the preparatory reaction and the remaining 2 from the Krebs cycle. Okay, so let's look at some nice details. What's the overall product of the Krebs cycle? It produces a guanosine triphosphate. The free energy of GTP pretty much is exactly equal to the free energy of ATP, so GTP can be converted into ATP very easily just by Le Chatelier's principle. Right, so you could even say the Krebs cycle produces, for every turn, 1 ATP, right, because they're basically equivalent. It's going to produce 3 NADH and 1 FADH2. And these are, right, NADH and FADH2 are coenzymes carrying high energy electrons, which are going to be donated. If we look to the slide on the right, NADH and FADH2 are going to donate those high energy electrons to the electron transport chain over here, which is still in what organelle? It's still in the mitochondria. So we're not going to leave the mitochondria until we're done. Okay, let's look a little bit more detail of the Krebs cycle. All right, so here's that acetyl group, the 2-carbon group, all right, that is going, acetyl-CoA, is going to donate that 2-carbon group to this carbon right here that has 4 carbons on it. Therefore, it's going to produce a 6-carbon unit, and that's going to regenerate coenzyme A so that it can undergo another preparatory reaction, bringing more acetyl groups into the Krebs cycle. And you can see all of these different intermediates right here. And this is, I don't think this is an exam figure this semester. All right, but what do we see when this cycle proceeds through all these different enzymatic steps? This Krebs cycle is also highly exergonic. It's an exergonic metabolic pathway, which means that that extra energy that's being released can be put into the production of ATP or these high energy electrons that are in NADH or FADH2. Right, so NAD going to NADH, that's not a favorable reaction, but since the Krebs cycle is exergonic, they can be driven very nicely. All right, so this very first step, you got 6 carbon atoms, but if you're going to have 2 decarboxylations, what are you left with again? Back with 4, right? So then you end up with 4 carbon atoms, which can then accept another acetyl group, so this cycle can go round and round and round and round, right? As long as you have acetyl-CoA able to donate that acetyl group for the Krebs cycle. But in the process of the Krebs cycle, not only do you get those 2 CO2s, right, one at this step and one at this step over here, but what else are being produced? NAD is being converted into NADH. How many times? I see 1, 2, 3 times, right? So for every turn of the Krebs cycle, you get those 3 NADHs. All right, now, but for every glucose, how many times does the Krebs cycle turn around? Okay, it turns around once for every pyruvate, but how many pyruvates do you get from one glucose? You get 2. So for every glucose, the Krebs cycle actually goes around twice. All right, so just you kind of have to remember that. For every one turn, you get 3 NADHs, and you see it also produces 1 FADH2 for every single turn. And in this step right here, it produces an ATP. All right, and if we look at all of these reactions right here, I see CO2, but do I see oxygen being necessary in this step? This only happens under aerobic conditions, it is true, but oxygen is not a direct participant in the Krebs cycle. So this phosphorylation of ADP, converting it into ATP, is still called substrate level phosphorylation. Just the same kind of phosphorylation that we saw in glycolysis, right? Substrate level phosphorylation. So the Krebs cycle makes, how does the Krebs cycle make an ATP? It makes it by substrate level phosphorylation. And you'll see what that means after we talk about another form of phosphorylation that we call oxidative phosphorylation. And oxidative phosphorylation, if we look on the slide on the right over here, right, happens with this electron transport chain. All right, so if we think for every glucose molecule, if we run that through glycolysis, how many ATPs does glycolysis make for every glucose? 2. And if we put those molecules, both of those pyruvates through the Krebs cycle, how many more ATPs do we get? 2. Okay, so now we got 4. So again, big deal. That's not a really big deal. We're interested, we really want to focus our attention finally on this electron transport chain over here. And we're getting there pretty soon. Okay. So that's what I want you to know about the Krebs cycle. The Krebs cycle can't be run backwards like glycolysis. Molecules can't flip back and forth from one side to the other. They have to go around exactly in this cycle, right, clockwise. And the Krebs cycle for every acetyl group produces 3 NADHs, 1 FADH2, and 1 ATP. And remember, it's times 2 for every glucose. Okay, so where is the Krebs cycle taking place? In the mitochondria. Oh, but also, don't forget, what else is the Krebs cycle producing that you have to get rid of? CO2. How many CO2s? 2 of them. Yeah, 2 of them. You don't have to know where they come off, but you should at least be aware that they're coming off in the Krebs cycle. Okay. All right, so now we have those coenzymes that are loaded with high-energy electrons. There's a lot of free energy associated with those electrons that are being carried by NADH and what other molecule? NADH and FADH2. And I don't care if you know the names for what those things really mean or not. Okay, you can just call them NADH or NAD. All right, so NADH is still in the matrix of the mitochondria, still on the inside, right over here. And they will bump into this inner mitochondrial membrane, and there are proteins in this membrane right here that will accept those electrons. Okay? And when those protons accept those electrons, what happens to them? What's the chemical way that we talk about that? They become reduced. Okay? In which case, then, NADH becomes oxidized back to NAD, which is good because you need NAD for what purpose? To get the Krebs cycle working, right? You need NADH for a Krebs cycle. You need NADH to run glycolysis. So the electron transport chain becomes reduced. It oxidizes NADH into NAD, so that keeps those other metabolic pathways open. And then those, and you can see, here's a plot of the electron transport chain, okay, which we have drawn down the progress of electron transport as a horizontal axis versus the free energy of these various metabolites. And of course, as you move up the scale over here, the free energy becomes greater. All right, so as you go from free these electrons in NADH all the way down, these electrons are being transferred from one molecule to another. So here is a series of oxidation reduction reactions. All right, as those electrons flow through those different chemical compounds, what happens to their energy? It, can you see on this chart right here? Do they increase in energy or do they lose energy? Lose energy. And what do you call that reaction where the products, right, these electrons down over here have less energy than the reactants? That's exergonic. So this electron transport chain is releasing a lot of energy. And through evolution, what has the mitochondria learned to do? Take that energy and drive endergonic reactions, namely the synthesis of ATP. Okay, so for every 2 electrons that are donated by NADH through the electron transport chain, how many ATPs are produced? If you just kind of, you don't have to study the slide too hard, it produces what? 1, 2, 3. Produces 3 ATP. That's almost as much as glycolysis and the Krebs cycle combined, right? Just 2 electrons. Okay. All right, so let's look at this a little bit more detail. Electrons will only flow through the electron transport chain if those electrons have some place to go when they get down to the bottom of it. And these electrons are going to combine with oxygen. So they're going to combine with oxygen with some hydrogen ions, and they're going to produce water. So the final product of the electron transport chain and indeed cellular respiration is water. Okay? So this electron transport chain will only run downhill like this, be exergonic, when what molecule is available? Oxygen. And so why are we inhaling all the time? To maintain our electron transport chain so that these electrons can end up in that oxygen that we're inhaling, producing water. And in so doing, mitochondria are producing what? 3 ATP for every NADH. All right, now there was another coenzyme that carries high energy electrons. What was that other one called? We got NADH is one. There is another one that's produced in a little bit of quantity in the Krebs cycle. FADH2 has some high energy electrons, but notice if we look at the energy scale right here, FADH2, does it have those electrons? Does it have lesser energy or the same or more? A little bit less. It donates its electrons further down in the electron transport chain because it doesn't have the same amount of energy. It misses this first phosphorylation step right here. So for each pair of electrons in FADH2, it can only produce 2 ATPs, not 3. But nonetheless, what molecule is necessary in order for FADH2 to give up its electrons to the electron transport chain? Oxygen still has to be there. Okay, and the other interesting thing is, what did we say about water? Water, of course, is the solvent that our body is dissolved in, but it's also what? A very important metabolite in many important chemical reactions, including the synthesis of ATP by this process right here. Oh, I'm so sorry. It's almost the weekend. Okay. During the test, make sure you turn your cell phones off. There's probably a way to turn off the, if I hit this button? No. Hit that button? Good. Because if I open it up, I'd have to say something. Okay. So, we have a highly exergonic reaction, those electrons flowing through these different chemical compounds. That exergonic reaction can be used to drive these endergonic reactions, right? And What was I going to say? Yeah, having to do with water. Okay, it's not only the solvent that our body is dissolved in, but it's a very important metabolite in many chemical reactions, like dehydration synthesis, right? Hydrolysis reactions, electron transport chain. Can't proceed unless it actually produces water. So your body does produce a lot of water, okay, via electron transport. I lost what I was talking about. Okay. Now, you might be interested to know, how does the electron transport chain actually do its job? And the other thing, well, before we go to the next slide, the other thing that we see on the slide are the names of some of these compounds that can that make up the electron transport chain. All right, there are things called coenzyme Q, various kinds of cytochromes, right, and they're dissolved in the membrane, right, the inner membrane of the mitochondria. Because what is a good model for you to have of any kind of membrane? Just a phospholipid bilayer? It should be what? The fluid mosaic model. So dissolved in any kind of membrane, the cell or organelles can put all kinds of other kinds of proteins to give special functions to that membrane, maybe for transport. And we're going to see what the special function of that inner mitochondrial membrane is on the next one of the next slides right here. All right, so don't forget NADH, FADH2 from the Krebs cycle, and even from glycolysis, carry those electrons to ETC. And when I say ETC, that is electron transport chain. And where is that located? This inner membrane of the mitochondria. We're going to look at that. Okay. And where are we right here on the slide on the right? We're now looking at the electron transport chain, and we call this aerobic respiration. Why do we call that aerobic respiration? Because it needs oxygen so that those electrons can combine with something. Otherwise, oh, maybe this is what I was going to say. If those electrons can't go away, right, you could think of this as like end product inhibition or Le Chatelier's principle. If we build up these metabolites over here, that's going to prevent what? That's going to force the reverse direction of this metabolic pathway. That's kind of a poor way of thinking about it, but it's okay for this class. Okay, just think of the law of mass action. All right, so slide on the right, we've got aerobic respiration. All right, this slide is okay. Where should these CO2s be? One CO2 should be coming from this preparatory reaction, and two should be coming out of the Krebs cycle. So they took a little bit of an artistic license right here. All right, but what arrow should be going in right here? What arrow should be going in? There's a molecule that's going into aerobic respiration. Besides these electrons, there's something else that's coming into aerobic respiration to produce this water molecule. That's the oxygen, right? So if you want to modify that diagram a little bit, that's okay with me. Okay. All right, so this process of producing, maybe this is what I was going to say, this process of producing 3 ATP for every NADH or 2 ATP for every FADH2, this is not substrate level phosphorylation. This is a really fancy special kind of phosphorylation. Since it requires oxygen, we call these steps right here oxidative phosphorylation. It's not substrate level. Where did substrate level phosphorylation take place? Krebs cycle, and also glycolysis as well. Glycolysis produces 2, Krebs cycle, 1 for every turn, 2 for every glucose. But this one right here is what we call oxidative phosphorylation, and of course that only happens when oxygen is available. Okay, so here we are now looking right inside the mitochondria, and here's the outer mitochondrial membrane, nice phospholipid bilayer right here, simplified it quite a bit. We haven't put any proteins in the membrane because we're not interested. Here's the inner mitochondrial membrane right here, and it's loaded with what? Really cool stuff, right? Some really interesting kinds of proteins and cytochromes that you have on one of the previous pages. All right, and then here is the matrix right here. This is where the Krebs cycle works, right? All right, so the Krebs cycle is producing a lot of NADH. NADH then can diffuse and bump into this first protein, in the electron transport chain. And what it does, it donates those electrons, high-energy electrons, right? And those high-energy electrons then can flow into the next component of the electron transport chain. And as it does, it releases energy, right? So these high-energy electrons release energy. In so doing, there are protons in the matrix that move into the intermembrane space over here. All right, so there is a high concentration of protons in the intermembrane space and a low concentration in the matrix. Low concentration in the matrix going to a high concentration in the inner membrane space. Now, what kind of process goes from low to high? Is that active or passive? Active. That's an active process, right? And you've learned secondary active transport, primary active transport uses ATP. Here is another special kind. I don't see ATP being used, but there is energy that's being used up. That energy came from these high-energy electrons. So as these high-energy electrons move through this first pump, it is actually pumping, going from low concentration to high, pumping protons into this inner membrane space. The electrons flow into another protein in the membrane, and then out of it into another cytochrome. This second protein right here can also pump protons from low to high. It requires energy. Where is it getting the energy from? The free energy of those electrons as they're flowing from one compound to another. All right, and then finally those electrons flow into this third protein right here, which can pump some more protons into this inner membrane space, going from low to high. That's active transport using the energy in those electrons to do that. And so that means then on Tuesday, we're going to have to finish this diagram up, okay? And this right here is what we call the chemiosmotic theory on how ATP is made using this gradient of protons. Now we have high protons in the inner membrane space, low in the matrix, and guess where those protons want to go? They want to go back to the matrix. Right? And so remember, there is energy in any kind of gradient. If there's a gradient in electrons, like in a battery, that's a power source. Instead of this being a battery, it's kind of like the reverse of a battery because it's not using electrons, it's using protons or hydrogen ions. And that can be used as a power source to look at this, make ATP as they flow back down. All right, so this is where we're going to start on Tuesday. We didn't run out of batteries today.